John Belushi was a superstar of comedy at the height of his fame in the late 1970s. He was in the phenomenally popular Saturday Night Live, as well as what was then the highest grossing comedy movie ever, Animal House, as well as having a number one album with his band, The Blues Brothers. You just heard him with Dan Aykroyd. The movie came in 1980. 2 years later, he was dead of an overdose of cocaine and heroin at the age of just 33. A new documentary by R.J. Cutler presents an intimate portrait of Belushi using audio tapes and letters belonging to Belushi's widow, Judy Belushi Pisano. I asked her how the documentary came about and why she chose to enable it now.
Yeah, well, there have been a couple of smaller, you know, television, A&E. Actually, I did one with MTV in like 1983. And none of them had been particularly full. Some of them were okay for television. I was always kind of kept at arm's length on those. And I had begun, after John died, I started, in fact, with the MTV when I began doing collecting interviews with people. I shot some in New York, Chicago, and L.A. And at some point, I think about probably when I met my second husband, I kind of set that stuff aside. And in fact, many years later, in 2005, I decided I wasn't going to do a documentary with him, which is what I thought I would do. But I thought maybe I'll do a book, because there's a lot of really great quotes and I could just sort of, you know, cherry pick them and put photos and be done with it. And I decided to work with someone, and I had met a young man, Tanner Colby, not too long before then. And he seemed a bright guy. He was doing some stuff with National Lampoon. So he knew a lot about the Radio Hour, which John and I both worked on. Anyway, I approached him. He started working with me. But as soon as he started looking at all the tapes I had, he said, "These are so good. We've got to do something of more substance." You know, and I knew he was right. I didn't really want to do it at the time, but I said, okay. And that's, we decided to do some more interviews, and most of those I put Tanner onto, and, you know, and then we made this book called Belushi, and that garnered interest from various folk wanting to do things. And because of my second marriage, I really didn't want to delve into a big documentary, but John Batstick, who was one of the producers, the lead producer on this documentary, approached me. I told him I really didn't want to, but he was very charming. He got me to meet him for lunch, and we had a nice lunch. And essentially, I said, yeah, I just really don't want to do one, though, at this time. And so he would call me yearly. And for a decade, he called me. And we had a little drama along the way, but we ended up going with it. And he brought in RJ, which I thought was a great idea, because I wanted someone who had a sense of history and therefore could maybe, because I think John kind of is an important cultural figure as well, that he's important in the entertainment world, but I think he overlapped in the time, an interesting time, and is a real representative of our generation.
When you said John was an important cultural figure, not just important for comedy, but important cultural figure, can you expand on that? What do you mean?
Yeah. I think he's just very representative of, you know, the 60s, although we were from the Midwest, and I think things come in behind the rest of the East, you know, the East Coast and the West Coast kind of come and hit you. So you're 5 years behind pretty much. So in like, you know, 73 was Kent State, I think, the culmination of, you know, when four students got killed in a demonstration at a college in this country. And it, you know, was a real catalyst for things changing from the simple demonstrations to the bigger stuff. And he was a person who was involved in all that. And as he hit comedy, he was like, people have talked about it to some extent. At Second City, he was the first true hippie. Harold Ramis was kind of considered their first hippie by lots of them, but he wasn't a true hippie. He played hippies, and he had long hair, and he knew the drug culture, but he wasn't truly a hippie. He hadn't been, you know, sleeping on people's floors and going to demonstrations and concerts and that kind of stuff like John had. And I think John was very political in his humor at first, in the earlier years, the Second City stuff to some extent, and, you know, in Lampoon, and especially, and the stuff that we did was much more satirical. And especially like with Second City, I mean, the shows weren't necessarily so political, but the improvs certainly were, because a big part of the day for the actors at Second City, or at least when John was there, was they would actually gather at a local, you know, place where they'd have breakfast and drink coffee and read the newspaper. They probably don't do that anymore. They would read the newspaper for hours, like 3-4 hours. They'd be just sitting there and chatting and talking, and they begin to say, "This, let's do something on this and that." And so a lot of the show for the improv was sort of contemplated during that morning. And the attention to, you know, news and all that was very important. Yeah, I think John was a leader. He was very clear. He was not going to go to Vietnam, he told me when I was a senior. So he's 2 years older. He was in college. Unequivocally, he would not go. He was going to go to Canada. He'd had a friend who'd gone up, who was a resistor, and he was going, you know, he took a trip up in 71 or so to see what it was like, to get a sense of what it would be like up there. And he told me he said a thing about Canada is the national bird is the mosquito.
You met him, you were a sophomore in high school when you met. What?
Yes.
Can you recall exactly when you met?
Well, I have a couple of different memories of, you know, different stages of meeting and whatnot, because I'm 2 years younger. And for instance, he had a band, and they played at our freshman sock hop, which was, you know, a mixer where the first dance for freshmen, and you would be in the gym. So you took off your shoes because you can't run the floor. And, you know, have a band and mix. And so I remember seeing him there, and I saw him around the hall and this and that. And he played football, so there's a lot of attention to football. So once again, you're seeing this person. And there was something called the Varsity Show, which was essentially a talent show. And one of the teachers who ran it, the drama teacher, got him to do the segues. So between different people's acts, as they moved something around, for, you know, brought out instruments or whatever it would be, John and did filler stuff. And he got a few friends to do scenes with him, and just made up quick little things to pass the time. Very funny. He was very visible.
It sounds as if he had a magnetic personality.
Yeah, no, he did. He looked different, you know, so you recognized him. In fact, I saw him, my father was a salesman, and he worked out of Chicago and often went out. And we went out for lunch one day for whatever reasons. And we're in Chicago with, you know, probably a customer. And we went to this nice steak restaurant, and I said, that kid, that busboy, goes to my school. And my dad said, oh, you must be mistaken. No kid from Wheaton would be coming out here to work this far from home to work. And it was his father's restaurant. So it was him. And my father was very surprised when he realized, because he'd been going there for lunches for some time.
At what point did you realize that he was going to be famous?
Well, you know, I don't know that I realized, but when he went off to college, after he'd done summer stock and he gotten really committed to wanting to be the actor, we'd been seeing Second City. Literally, as we walked out of this first time we ever saw Second City, he turned to me and said, "This is what I want to do." And so as he was, you know, we're kissing in the car, and he's going to be leaving to go to freshman year of college. And he said, "You probably should break up with me, because I'm going to be an actor, and I'll probably never make any money, and you'll have to support us." And I said, "Well, okay." So, you know, I can do that. But I kind of always thought he would be successful. But I can't say that I thought he's going to be. I did. I kind of thought he was like a Sinatra, that he was going to be really big, that he could do a lot of different things. And so that was kind of just, I'd say, more fantasy thinking than some kind of knowledge. But maybe, who knows?
One of the reasons that have been suggested about why this documentary has been made is that it serves as a corrective to Bob Woodward's book, 1984 book about John, called Wired. Is that true?
Well, that wasn't the intent, but anything that represents John fairly would be that. I mean, the problem with Woodward's book wasn't that it had untruths per se, but the overall was untrue. It was not a true portrait of John. You know, Woodward is very good at gathering facts, although I have to say, I handed him all that stuff, so I don't know really how good he is at it. I mean, but he certainly siphoned through it all and pulled together an impressive amount of information. And again, I set up the whole structure for him. I gave him the whole timeline and everything. But he totally did not understand who he was. When I read it, it felt like a play in which the actor is so wrong, you know, that they're saying these words, but it just doesn't ring true at all, you know. And that's so I wasn't, you know, so I figured, you know, I mean, yeah, I was hoping to be able to see an A-list kind of documentary about John that I would think offered something to those who care that was, you know, insightful to some level and represented him. But this one, I know, I feel like it's not exactly how I would do something, or if I could edit it, I would love to edit it again. I think it wouldn't be terribly different probably to the average eye, but I would definitely change some things and emphasize some other things. But
you do not see John as, you did not and do not see him as destined for self-destruction, which I think Woodward did.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I mean, I have enough friends who had drug issues who have been successful to walk away, who, in my opinion, and many people, other people's opinions, seemed much less likely to survive than John. Sad to say, it's not funny, but I just think James Taylor actually said in his interview that I had done that he saw John's death as an accident. It didn't have to happen, but it did. And I think he's someone who knows. And I think that's true.
And yet, you know, there's Harold Ramis saying he had these appetites completely out of control for everything, and I did not see him surviving such fame.
Yeah. Yeah, he's referring specifically to when the Blues Brothers hit, and it was such a wild night and all that, and it struck him, maybe, you know, I think in retrospect that sounds really heavy, and I mean Harold's was a brilliant and insightful guy, and I'm sure he had that thought, and it came back to him, you know. I mean, I had those thoughts too. I was afraid he'd die at various times from his recklessness, but I didn't feel it was his intent. I think that the scary part was, I think he did think he was indestructible. I'm sure there's a part of him that was, you know, had a certain aspect of fear, but he didn't show that particularly often.
Did you ever try to get him to go to rehab?
Yeah, well, not in the... At that point, I knew no one who'd ever gone to rehab. You know, there's quite a stigma. It was still a time when people would say things like, it'll ruin your career. John didn't want to go that. He, you know, when he would talk about being sober, and he did, you know, therapy and did some things to try to, you know, various things to try to help him with that. But he did not want to go to rehab. And I did think about like just sort of trying to catch him and put him in there. But I felt that would be so, it would destroy our trust is what I was afraid of at the time. You know, I second guessed whether that was if that would have been a good thing or not. And to be honest, you know, you look at someone like Chris Farley, he went in and out of rehab like crazy. It comes from some lack that you're trying to fill, and you start using these drugs, and then the drugs take over. And that's, so you got to reclaim the person from the drugs and then work on what that problem is. And it's obviously very difficult. In fact, you know, yeah. The percentage of success is very low.
I mean, there must have been a lot of people, yourself included, after John died, who thought, I mean, I think Dan Aykroyd voices it as well, who thought, if only I'd got there, if only I'd done that, if only I'd said this.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
How did you work that out?
Well, I think I just sort of at first accepted that I was going to carry on for a time and give the idea that time could make things feel better.
Did it?
I don't think time itself does, but I think how you deal with the issues unfolds in time. So yes, I feel like I feel people often will say you'll never heal from something like this, or it never goes back to normal. Of course, it never, there is no normal, so it doesn't go back. But I do think you can heal. I feel like, it's just not to say I can't find a pang in my heart sometimes because of something. But in general, I'm resolved that John died, that he had a really, when I can bookend his life now and look at it, and he had a pretty amazing life. Yes, there were struggles. Everyone has struggles. And his were big, just like everything about him was big. But he had a great life. He was not, that's one thing. I do feel the documentary a little gloomier. I think of his life as pretty joyful. He wasn't manic depressive. I don't think it was an anger management problem either, but I just think whatever was sad, his sadness and his space or the lack of spirituality, whatever it was, he hadn't found how to deal with that yet.
I'm talking to Judy Belushi, who contributed to a new documentary about her late husband, John Belushi. Carrie Fisher says something in the documentary about drugs not being the problem, sobriety is the problem, implying that, you know, once you've experienced the highs, then life is very boring without it. And I'm guessing that John Belushi had a very low boredom threshold.
Yeah, that's a very interesting statement. And of course, it's true. I mean, getting sober is very hard because now you're sober, but you haven't fixed whatever it is. I mean, thing James Taylor mentioned to me when he got clean, he was saying like he was just like a 14-year-old boy again in his emotional being, because that's when he kind of signed off. And so there's that to, you know, that kind of thing to deal with. I mean, it's a big, big thing. But also I have to say, I mean, obviously Carrie was a tortured soul and they did share that. And John did express, actually, he didn't express being bored so much as being afraid that he was boring.
Different thing, that, right? You know,
which is like, you know, you're going, no, that's not, it's like, you know, you're not boring. There's no, you could, you know, it's like he could be a couch potato. He could go into a quiet zone but it was just such a peaceful energy when he did that. It was, you know, everything he did was sort of contagious. So.
But he was not, you say, I think, the stereotypical tormented comic. He had,
I don't think he
wasn't
was.
Riddled, I mean, with demons.
Well, he must have, you know, I don't know, like riddled. No, I mean, he wasn't constant. He did not have a constant, you know, didn't have a dark cloud. He wasn't dragging through life. He was up and ready to go, and what are we going to do? And he was like a little kid a lot of the times in his excitement over things. But he did get wrapped up in, you know, very passionate about his work and how it was going, and then combining the high energy of all that and the pressure and the fighting for things, and then you start bringing in drugs, and then it's a terrible combination of elements colliding. And I think it happened to our generation. I mean, that's what, back to that idea. You know, I mean, look at the, you know, the problems we have now with prescription drugs. You know, sure. So many people who thought, you know, shaking a finger at drug addicts, but had no idea that, oh, I am one too.
Yes.
So, you know.
Yes.
And of course now, you know, there's so much more information, and yet it doesn't make the solving the problem any easier, but it is helpful that people do get it. And even just what, you know, put on a death certificate now, if for the same death John has, it could well be written up very differently, because we just see now that it's not about a crime, it's about a problem, serious health problem.
I was going to say, if only is a kind of pretty pointless game to play, but if only he'd stayed alive long enough for Dan Aykroyd to put him in Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I know. Yes, I can't say I'm clear as to how it got altered from when Billy came in. I don't think it was altered a whole bunch, but, you know, I just think Billy brought his personality in as John would have. And either way, I'm sure it would have been great, to be honest. And also Spies Like Us, you know, it was an interesting script. And again, I haven't, you know, read it for 30 years or whatever it is, but it was much more satirical in the original reading. Danny was kind of very up. He was talking about the
we didn't think of it as a war there, but he was talking about our soldiers battling in Afghanistan. It's like, I remember reading it going, is this stuff true? You know? And he's like, yeah. And so it was very interesting. I felt it was much more, I felt a little more like Dr. Strangelove. It was, you know, kind of pointed in much more of a satirical way, as I said. So, and anyway, I think that probably would have been a different film. And I can't say, I mean, it was a comedy still, but I think they would have gone, I think John would have wanted to keep it that way more. And I think because Chevy is more silly things, he's more about expressions and saying the unexpected. And, you know, I don't think the political thing works so well.
You said something interesting in an interview. You said, had John died in his sleep, we would view his life much differently.
Yeah, I believe that.
But the fact is, he didn't die in his sleep.
That's true.
And that's crucial, isn't it? I mean, the fact is that he overdosed, you believe accidentally. There's no reason to believe that it wasn't accidental, or is there? I don't know. What do you think?
No, I think it was accidental. I think, sadly, you know, if someone had been there, it would have saved him. But, you know, it is what it is.
He was unhappy about the way his career was going. The movie Neighbours was not going well. And he couldn't cope with bad reviews. He needed to be loved. Is that what happens to people who become very famous? They have to be loved all the time.
I think there is some, it might be serotonin, you know, something that goes on when you're famous. If you're not, you know, really vigilant with your protecting your, you know, your mind, which we always must be anyway. But with so many, you know, stimulus, that so many people putting their energy on you a certain way, it, you know, takes fortitude.
When you read those letters for the purposes of this documentary, had you looked at them in the years in between his death?
I keep them in a particular place. I can't tell you when I last did. I knew I was giving them very personal things.
Yeah. I mean, they're terribly moving and indeed give a much fuller picture of John Belushi than the kind of one-dimensional figure that, you know, his death has left us with. He had so much going for him, didn't he?
He did. It, you know, makes it all more frustrating and a sad story for that very reason.
Someone said in the documentary, I can't remember who it was, I don't think it was Harold Ramis, he said that you and John were codependent. What does that mean?
He might have said something. He did say something along that line. He did. He also said that I was as dark and funny as any of them, which was my favorite line.
Yes.
But, he said probably codependent. I mean, it's a typical addict situation, someone who will support you. I mean, I actively thought I was doing things to help him. And the change, you know, the approach changed a lot, 360 degrees probably throughout our relationship. I mean, you know, for one, we were doing drugs together much of that time. He always did more. And so there was always that you need to back off kind of point. And he would, ultimately, you know, through the years. And so that...
You're talking about cocaine, are you?
Or whatever the drug was.
I mean, seemed to be the drug of choice in those years, and it was relatively normalized.
From Saturday Night Live on. I mean, in the documentary, they give the impression cocaine started during Lemmings. It did not. But anyway, it was the first place cocaine... First time we saw cocaine. It's like, here, would you like to try cocaine? You know, it was something, I'm not going to say he never did it during that time, just saying it wasn't around that much. But you know, first it was smoking marijuana, and then, you know, psychedelics, et cetera, throughout, you know, the drug culture. We were very much a part of that.
But then heroin
was not part of our life. And interestingly, there were various times when people we knew were doing it, and John was very vocal about thinking that it was not a, you know, thing to futz with. But whatever, somewhere at the end there, he got curious about it. Whatever happened, can't say.
Did you know that he was doing heroin?
No, not till he died.
Wow. So that was a terrible shock to you in a way. I suppose it was an indication.
Yeah, well, it was. And of course, the implication that he'd been, that this was his way, I knew was incorrect. I you know, pretty well say he was not, you know, doing, he's certainly not shooting up until the end of his life, which is what the autopsy confirmed. But, you know, whatever.
How long did it take you to put yourself back together again?
It's hard to say. It was a slow process. It went in stages, you know, because I was so dead inside and uninterested in living. And it was because, literally, I remember just thinking, well, I really, you know, my family's going through a lot too. They'd be just devastated if I was to, you know, check out. I can hang in here. I'm going to, you know, but if this is how life is, I can't do that for other people. And I thought I'd wait a year. And at the end of the year, I thought, this is not much better, but there is a little bit of a change and I should give it more time. By the third year, I was over that. I was fine. I mean, not fine, but I didn't feel that way anymore.
You could see the point in carrying on living.
Yeah. I mean, what, I remember once waking up in the middle of the night, like a crash. It sounded like someone had broken a window. Like maybe, I lived in New York City. I was alone. Didn't scare me in the least. And I literally thought, maybe they'll kill me. Like someone's breaking in. Maybe they'll kill me. So I was pretty low. I understand when people talk about, you know, not caring if they, you know, just not caring. I mean, I didn't really want to act it out, but I felt, like I said, I didn't care if it was Stan. But yeah, it totally changed. I started, I think for me, one of the important things was that I wasn't raised with the conviction to any religion. I've always felt very connected to nature and spiritual in my own way, but I didn't have any kind of real art, sort of the thing I thought of as something I could structure things around and think about. But I started to look at what the different religions in the world shared. I was wanting to see what concepts and whatever they all shared. And I started with sort of comparing Christianity and Buddhism and, you know, got into Hinduism ultimately and just reading lots of different things and alternative things. And I found a connection, you know, to an eternal life, and it's changed everything.
When did you find that connection?
Well, I can say that in 1987, I moved out to the vineyard permanently. At that time, I had just begun to.
This is Martha's Vineyard.
Yes, yeah. To Martha's Vineyard, where I live now. A book called The Course in Miracles, and I started that one, and that really changed things for me. And so starting around then, it was a big change. I mean, I was ready. I'd read a lot of things. I had, you know, a bunch of different ideas. I was what one strong message, you know, just the idea that life is eternal. And then also sort of just finding all, you know, the basic stuff, pretty simple. And they, you know, I, you know, found my way. I was lost. Now I found.
And if life is eternal, does that comfort you about John?
Yeah, I guess it does. I mean, before I even could say this is how I feel about things, I mean, I from the time he left, I felt he was around. I would feel his energy sometimes. And, I just wonder about that. I don't know. I was saying with my parents, I feel like there are times I feel like they've kind of, I think they're always with us. I, you know, it's probably more to do about where you're placing your thoughts, but it can bring a feeling along, an energetic feeling, a connection.
When you consider John's extraordinarily rich career, what do you think was his best thing?
Well, I don't know. That's, you know, I'm the sort of like, I don't have a favorite color. I'm very bad at I like them all. Mm-hmm. But I think in Blues Brothers, just because of the breadth of it, that it's music and created this great film on top of that.
Not just the movie, but performance art, as somebody said.
Yeah, the whole thing about it. I think that's certainly, I think it's, I know it's really his legacy, because you know, I deal with his legacy, and that's the thing that most people are interested in. Mm. And has the most legs because of the music.
I wish you well. I'm glad that you are happy with the documentary. Do you feel like it's, I'm trying to find another word for closure. I don't know what.
Well, to some extent, yes, because I don't expect to do another one. I didn't either way, but at least not, you know, now I feel like it's, something's there that I can feel good about, and people do other ones, they do other ones, but there's something that at least, you know, I mean, I actually would love to see someone who really focused on his work and went to that way. But an unexpected result of it, which has been interesting and kind of wonderful, probably the, just backtrack there, the most nerve-wracking part for me would be how John's family and my siblings, who also love John, and his friends and co-workers who are close, how they feel about this documentary, because these things can be hurtful. And that's what worried me most. And I first played it for Jimmy, my brother-in-law, Jim. And I was laughing because, first of all, he started it late at night. So he realized it was going to be longer than he thought. So he stopped halfway through. And if you recall, about the first half of the thing is very upbeat and light. And then in the second half, it starts going. So he was real up about it. And then the next day, he saw it. And it made him sad, of course. And that's okay. You know, I mean, I'm more concerned about things like is the animation going to make him crazy because it's his family being animated, you know, or is it going to be, or something someone says, you know. But for 3 days, we talked about it. And every day he finished up a little more positive and a little less on the sad side and all that. And then the third one, he was heading out somewhere, and he came by and stopped and said, it's a really good documentary. And that's great. But bigger than that was that the second generation here, my nephews and niece and my son, you know, who, especially the Belushi kids, they really only know John as a famous uncle who was an actor and died of drugs. They grew up in L.A., not Chicago, where that part of the family is. They just didn't really know a whole bunch about that side of the family. So the documentary opened that up and again made everybody really sad. But what I realized is that they're mourning. They didn't know him, obviously. And this documentary helped them understand him as a person. And so now they felt the loss. And I think also in some way it created something for the family that, because when John died, it was also shocking and taken up by other things, police investigations and things, that the mourning was pretty muddied. And I think this was just sort of a moment to go back to that moment and actually just feel the loss. And so that's all I got to say on that.
That was Judy Belushi, who contributed to a new documentary about her late husband, John Belushi. The documentary is called Belushi. It's available here in New Zealand via DocPlay. And you can find a link to that on our webpage.